You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Whether you need a battery for your truck or batteries for your trail cameras, Interstate Batteries has the batteries for your everyday life. Stop into a local retail location. They have thousands upon thousands of them all over the United States. Or go and visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ohio Huntsman Podcast. Today we're going to talk about some changes that have been made recently to duck stamps and the artwork that gets applied to the duck stamps. So that's what today's episode is about. Before we talk about that though, I want to talk about our sponsor, Monster Whitetail Grub. So we're getting real close to deer season. If you're looking to get out opening day or maybe take your kids out opening day, having some sort of feed out to attract deer early season is a great tactic to use. I know Jacob plans to use that with his daughter, so Monster Whitetail Grub is a great way to do that. They've got their signature Monster Whitetail Grub feed, which is a high protein feed with mineral mixed in. You can get all kinds of different additives added to it. They've got flavored corn, which turns regular corn into more of a long range attractant. And they've got regular mineral, so whatever you need, they have it. Check them out. Go to ohiohuntsman.com/sponsors. There you'll find a link to get in touch with them and see what they have to offer. They may carry it in a retail location near you, so chat with them about that. If not, you can order it direct from Monster Whitetail Grub, and you can deal with them directly. So with that, we're going to get into the episode, but as I said, check out Monster Whitetail Grub. It's a great product. Welcome to the Ohio Huntsman Podcast, where three brothers, Jason, Jacob, and Jeff, discuss all things hunting in Ohio. Our goal is to be your source for accurate and reliable hunting news and conservation issues in the great state of Ohio, as well as some fun and interesting conversations along the way. This is the Ohio Huntsman Podcast.
Are you listening?
All right. So the main topic for today, I think we're going to talk about duck stamps. And there's been a recent change here that I know has got Jeff fired up. So we're going to talk about that. And then depending on how long that takes, there's a few other things that might be interesting to listeners. So I don't know. The duck stamp topic, I guess, Jeff, can you summarize how the artwork, I guess, as a starting place, like how the artwork for the duck stamps is generated?
Yeah, so there's an art competition. I don't know the exact specifics, but there's a art competition that has specific guidelines, and then it's judged, and the winner becomes the federal duck stamp.
And so anybody, to your knowledge, anybody can submit artwork for the contest?
Yes.
Right?
Yes. To my knowledge, anyone can submit their artwork for the contest. Yes.
And then that the artwork that goes on that stamp is, not only people collect duck stamps just to collect duck stamps, but it's also required to hunt waterfowl, right?
Yes, yes. The duck stamp, the federal duck stamp, is required to hunt waterfowl anywhere in the United States. I was thinking all migratory birds, but that's not true because you don't need it to hunt doves, and doves are a migratory bird.
Right, yeah.
But so, any waterfowl.
Okay. So recently, and Jeff, you're going to have to probably take over here because I don't fully understand what went on, other than there was a change to the stipulations on what has to be in the artwork or what has to be included in the image in order for it to be considered in the contest, or I guess for it to be to meet the guidelines in order to be judged in the contest to that, to therefore hopefully become the artwork that goes on the federal duck stamp. Is that correct so far?
Yeah. So 2 years ago, the rules were changed to require that the artwork have a hunting element in it. Now, what that element is mostly up to the artist. You know, it can be a decoy. It can be a call. You know, it could be potentially like a blind. I would assume potentially it could be like a retriever. You know, it has to have some sort of hunting element in the artwork to be accepted. That rule changed 2 years ago.
So prior to that, there was no such stipulation.
Correct. Now, that doesn't mean that people didn't put that stuff in their duck stamp artwork, but it wasn't required.
Okay.
So, starting with this year's stamp, that element was required. You know, because it takes a while, you know, like the current art competition that's going on now will be for next year's stamp. So this year was the first year that the hunting element was required. So if you look at the 2021-2022 duck stamp, there's a duck call on it.
Okay.
And this rule change was made to honor hunting heritage, you know, because basically federal duck stamps, well, not even basically, federal duck stamps came to be because waterfowl hunters said, hey, we're really alarmed by this massive decline in waterfowl. So, like, we want to do something to raise money. You know, basically, we want to be taxed to raise money to help support waterfowl and waterfowl habitat.
Right.
So that's why duck stamps, federal duck stamps, came into existence. So to honor the hunting heritage, and also it was kind of to coincide with federal duck stamps raising $1 billion for conservation, you know, like total over the lifetime of duck stamps, they made this rule that permanently connected hunting to these stamps by requiring there to be a hunting element in the stamp. Obviously, because there is a collector's market, while it is small compared to the market of people buying these stamps as a license, as a hunting license, there is a non-hunting collector's market for federal duck stamps. So obviously those people got a little offended, a little hurt, a little upset that the rules were changing, and changing to include something that they may or may not agree with. You know, some of these people just are completely ethically opposed to hunting, so it ruins the stamp for them to have a hunting element in them.
So those people, I mean, we don't have one to ask, but they're buying the stamp for purely for collecting, or they're buying it to collect, but also as a way, like a conservation way to help waterfowl? Or do you know?
I'm sure there's a little bit of both. You know, some people are buying them to help waterfowl, you know, just, you know, some people like to collect them and like to make the donation.
Right.
But also, waterfowl stamps are also used as an admission to some other places, like some federal waterfowl refuges. You know, in order to go to them, you have to buy a federal duck stamp.
Okay.
Like there are other places, mostly targeted, in my opinion, at like bird watchers. You know, where it basically, if you want to come here and look at birds, you have to buy a stamp.
Right. Okay.
You know, like you're basically duck stamps helped fund this place, build whatever it is. So if you want to utilize it, you have to also contribute to this pool of money. So there is, well, be it small, and the exact numbers are hard to actually come by, you know, because I emailed the Fish and Wildlife Service and asked, like, after this rule change came out, because now to kind of jump ahead real quick, the rule that required that hunting element has now been taken away. They changed the rules back so that the hunting element is no longer required. So after this news came out, and they basically said it was because of this outcry of the non-hunting public, I emailed them and asked, you know, what percentage of stamps are bought by non-hunters? And their answer to that was, there's no way of knowing. We don't know, you know, because we don't ask, you know, at the sale why people are buying them. So it's just kind of a gut feeling, you know, like no one really has good numbers on it, on what percentage. But everyone believes that the vast majority are being bought by hunters as a hunting license. But no one really knows what percentage are being bought by people who just want to collect the stamp, or, you know, want to donate to conservation, or are buying the stamp for another, you know, a bird watching reason.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I obviously don't know, but it feels like the percentage of people that would have a problem with that would be pretty low. I mean, what I'm picturing in my head is, you know, maybe somebody that waterfowl hunted as a kid, or used to waterfowl hunt, but, you know, whatever, life happens, don't hunt anymore, but they still like the idea of supporting waterfowl, collecting the stamps. And so you know, you wouldn't think those people would have an issue with having a hunting element in the artwork. They came to know about federal duck stamps through hunting and the good that they do, and so on. Now, I guess that's not to say that somebody, as they got older, thought, well, I can just, you know, we don't have to hunt them in order to help them. We can just buy these duck stamps, and now I'm, you know, against hunting, or I guess that's a possibility. But yeah, it seems like the number of people or the percentage of people buying the stamps be awfully low.
Yeah. And I mean, there's no real way of getting accurate numbers.
I wonder if they saw like a massive decrease in stamps bought.
Well, I mean, this year's stamp would be the first one with the hunting element. So they wouldn't even have those numbers yet.
Oh.
You know, because, I mean.
Well, didn't the one from year 2019 have a hunting element in it, too?
I'm not sure of the year, but recently there was a wood duck. It was a wood duck stamp. It had a wood duck on it, and there was a decoy. I don't know if that was 19 or 18. I know it wasn't the 2020 stamp.
Right.
And potentially they saw a decrease because of that. I mean, it's possible. I don't know. That might be information that's actually, I mean, it should be. Someone should be able to provide that information.
I mean, because money talks, right? Like, if they, you know, they awarded the artwork to somebody who chose to add a hunting element, then they required a hunting element, and, you know, while they, so you're saying the stamp for this year is the stamp that has the duck call on it?
Yes, for
so
this
people
year.
Aren't really buying that stamp yet, or
well,
are
I mean,
just
they,
starting to.
Yeah, they're just starting to, if you will. I mean, I was late to it, but I just bought my stamp last weekend. You know, because early goose season starts this upcoming weekend. You know, we're recording this on September 1st. And I actually bought the last stamp, the last duck stamp at my post office.
Oh, okay.
So they said, you know, she said, oh, you know, you're in luck. We got one left. There was a guy that just came in here who he had been calling around trying to find them. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize, you know, that you guys could sell out, basically. You know, last year I showed up and asked for one and you gave it to me. And so I just thought, well, every year I show up to the post office and I just buy a stamp. You know, this would be my second year waterfowl hunting. So I didn't, you know any better. But yeah, she said, you're getting the last one. So if you have any buddies, tell them they got to go somewhere else.
And they don't get any more? Like, they can't order more?
I don't know. I didn't ask. I assume if they hit zero, they have none left. I assume they do order more.
This seems to me like it doesn't cost any money to print a duck stamp. So, like, why would they have a limited supply? That's just weird to me. They should never run out. They should never even get close to running out. It just doesn't, I don't understand that. You're not losing money by printing, you know, in the grand scheme of things, 100 duck stamps and throwing them away at the end of the year. Like, you're not losing money doing that. Right. Like, I don't understand how they can run out.
Yeah,
that's weird.
You got a point.
And I know you had trouble last year, Jeff. Didn't you have to look around and find a post office that had them?
Yes, but yes, I had to look around to find a post office that had them. But once I found the one that, you know, that had them, I assumed that they would have, always have them.
Right.
You know, and I think half of the time it's just, you know, some of the other post offices, I think, just didn't know what I was talking about.
Yeah.
You know, they're small post offices. And it's like, no, I don't think we have that.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. But so now what has happened is they have changed the rules back to no longer require the hunting element. And one thing that really bothered me was a lot of conservation organizations were like sharing the news story and kind of acting like it was a good thing. Like, oh, it's going to give, you know, artists more options. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's, you know, having that hunting element connects these stamps and the money from them to hunters and makes them look, you know, gives us some, you know, something to show us in a positive light.
Right.
You know, I think it was very necessary to add that hunting element because, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, a federal duck stamp, you know, it was apparent to everyone what who's buying federal duck stamps and where that money's coming from. It was obvious. And now it's not as obvious, because there is a small group of people who are buying them for, you know, the art or other reasons. So I think it was very necessary to add that hunting element so that people understood, you know, that this is hunters raising this money.
Yeah, because, so I mean, I guess, like we said a minute ago, you know, we don't know the numbers, but you wouldn't be surprised to find out that if hunters stopped buying duck stamps, all of a sudden there's no money being raised, no real money, right? Yes, there are some people that are buying them just to collect them, just to help ducks, but you've got to imagine the vast majority of people buying duck stamps are buying them so they can hunt waterfowl.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my opinion, my statement is I have never known anyone who bought a federal duck stamp that didn't buy it on the grounds of like hunting and hunting conservation, because you see them in a lot of places. I mean, a lot of people don't know what they are, but you'll see like the people have them on their walls. It's like a printout of the artwork and then the stamps in the corner. You know, so those people are buying them, you know, so I do know people who have bought that those pieces of artwork, but all of those people, I am pretty sure, you know, we're well aware that duck stamps are related to hunting and hunting conservation of waterfowl. You know, they weren't buying it because this is a pretty piece of artwork.
Yeah, the vet we go to, I'm pretty sure, has duck stamp art. Okay, you guys go to the same vet?
Yes, I go to the same vet as you. Yes.
Okay.
And he does. And our grandpa has some on his in the stairway up to his office.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, so they're there. And but I'm pretty sure our vet's a duck hunter. You know, he has labs.
Right, yeah.
I think they need to make a deer stamp.
Yeah, federal deer stamp.
A federal deer stamp, yeah, so that we can buy deer artwork and hang it up.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that's kind of, I don't know, weird, is because duck hunting, like, is seen all the way from, like, you know, super high class, you know, because, like, the artwork stuff is, like, you know, seen as being pretty high class and posh, and then you get like, you know, there's a wide variety, you know, Duck Dynasty basically is the other end of that spectrum.
Right, yeah.
You know, where it's there's a very different public images of duck hunting.
Yeah, that's a good point. It would be interesting to see how something, I don't know, I think today people would like complain and moan to no end if you added a $25 deer stamp that you had to buy to hunt deer. But yeah, like I know, you know, Ohio, they always ask, do you want to contribute to the wildlife fund or whatever when you buy your tag and license. But if you got something, and I think like with your donation, maybe you can get a subscription to the Wild Ohio magazine or something like that. But if you got something that, you know, you could, you know, put some marketing around or just, I don't know, get people excited about like collecting these things. Like, oh yeah, what's right. The, you know, like we've started, I don't know, sort of unofficially collecting the regs books.
Right. They That's got what different... I was going to say.
Yeah.
Is there are still people who they want their printed regs book because they want the cover art. Like the cover art is what they are hoping for. They're looking for, you know, which sometimes it's a piece of artwork, you know, and then other times it's a picture. But they like to cover, they like to get those covers and collect the covers.
Yeah. I mean, I was in a gun shop this past weekend and they had the regs books laying in there and I picked one up. Not because I ever, I might thumb through it while I'm sitting at the cabin, but I use the electronic version now. But, you know, we've kind of started an unofficial collection of the regs books. And if you could do something like that, I think, you know, maybe it's optional or probably the only way to do it today, because, you know, people cried about adding a couple dollars to the tags and license prices. You know, if there was some optional thing where you got it's a stamp, it's a whatever, I don't know what it is, but it's something that could have like a collectible element to it. You know, I'm thinking, I don't know if you guys know, like Ryan Kirby's artwork.
I've heard of it.
No, I'm not familiar.
Well, look him up. He does like drawings of not just whitetail, but other wildlife. But he's a wildlife artist, right? So like, if you could, I guess, much like the duck stamps, right? It's a piece of art that you're getting. There again, I don't know what it is, but maybe it's a stamp, maybe it's a whatever, a glossy page that they mail to your house that you could put in a frame, you know, whatever it is. Seems like you could raise some extra money for conservation that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'd pay $5 for it without even thinking twice.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the same amount that Wild Ohio magazine is, right? I think it's a $5 contribution.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So, it's not like for a stamp. It's not like they don't already have the infrastructure set up, because there's a state wetland stamp you have to buy. So they already have the system to make them set up.
Okay.
So, yeah, we may be on to something there, you know, giving people ideas. Yeah.
We need to take a quick break here and talk about our sponsor, Mastin's Deer Sense. Mastin's is a deer scent company. They're also a predator scent company, but since we're coming up on deer season, I'm going to talk about their deer scents. So they have your standard liquid scents, but they've got some interesting scent combinations, meaning, you know, they combine scents from a bunch of different scent glands on a whitetail. So interesting in that way. If you're just looking for doe estrus, they've got that also. So they've got that. They've got scented gel crystals, which you can refresh with the liquid scents. They've got scented candles, like deer scented candles, that you can use with their double scent stacker. So lots of interesting options to check out with Mastin's. And you guys have heard me say in the past, their prices are very reasonable. So check them out. Go to mastinsdeerscents.com. See what they have to offer. Browse around. Look at their different scents that they offer and the different scent products that they offer. And if you find something you like, order it direct from Mastin's and they'll ship it to your house. So with that, we'll get back into the conversation. But like I said, check them out, mastinsdeerscents.com. All right. Well, anything else we need? I mean, I don't know. Is there anything to do? I guess if there was a bunch of hunter outcry that, like, hey, we liked having the duck stamp or the hunting element in the duck stamp.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I my opinion is I don't think we should take this lying down as a hunting community. You know, whether you duck hunt or not, this was something very positive. I mean, when I found out that they were doing this, I was very happy because it was showing the hunting community in a positive light. You know, and it was going to, right, to do that for the future, you know. So I was very happy about this. I felt like as hunters, we were being respected and appreciated, you know, for what we're doing for conservation. So whether you're a duck hunter or not, I'd reach out to whoever you can. And, you know, I'm sure in the future this topic will come back up. And when it does, you know, make sure you voice your support for the rule being changed back. You know, because I believe that this change was more or less just a political change. It was to erase all legacy of the former administration. You know, they're systematically just erasing everything he did, and this was one of the things that he did. And I feel that this one was, you know, whether you agree with most of the things he did, you know, or not, this was definitely something he got right. You know, his administration got right.
So I didn't even think about that. So yeah, this rule change happened under the Trump administration.
Correct.
And now the Biden administration is rolling that back.
Yes. And I believe it's, you know, they're saying it was because of a public outcry and, you know, just to make, you know, give the artist more freedom and whatever. But I believe it's a political move.
Yeah.
I agree. I think it's just another undoing of what Trump did. You know, their goal is to reverse that. You know, he was, the Democratic side thinks, right or wrong, that President Trump was the worst president ever in the history of the country. So anything he did, we have to fix. So we have to undo it, reverse it, switch it. Right. I think that definitely played a large role.
Right.
I don't think there's any way it didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is a government agency. So they get hit with just as much government, you know, I don't even know what the word I want to call it is, but garbage is everyone else. You know, every other agency where when there's a change of administration, everything in your entire line of work changes.
Right.
You know, there's a big power shift. So, yeah, I assume that in the future, this will become a topic again. And when it does, make sure you voice your support. No matter, you know, if you're a waterfowl hunter or not, because this is just one thing that basically forces people to see the positive things that hunters do. You know, the general public is pretty ignorant to hunting in general. You know, they think we're just a bunch of cold-blooded killers, right. You know, or they're just completely indifferent to hunting. So they have no idea of all the good that hunting does. You know, the average person has no idea that almost every animal they see is basically here because hunters decided to keep it, you know, decided that that conservation was important. You know, because when the federal duck stamp was created, most of the waterfowl that you see today were not in most of the United States, you know, and before hunting licenses, you know, in most states, a lot of states got rid of their deer population because of overhunting. And so the money from, you know, the modern hunting has brought all of this back. And
yeah,
it's so, yeah, it's just, I really hope that hunters don't take this lying down and fight to, you know, get the hunting element added back to the duck stamp, but also, you know, just fight to have our contributions seen. Yeah. you know, like the signs that are on some public areas now that say basically like this public land is brought to you by money raised from, you know, the sale of hunting and fishing license, or, you know, so just fight to kind of keep hunting and the positive things it does in the public eye.
Yeah, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. So I guess two other things here real quick before we wrap up. I sent this to you guys, but I wanted to make the listeners aware of it. The Ohio being a straight-walled legal state, straight-walled cartridge legal state, this is relevant to us. Vortex now offers, I think new this year, they now offer a scope that was designed specifically for straight-walled rifles. I guess maybe more so the reticle was designed for straight-walled rifles. So it's got the subtensions or the different hash marks inside or on the reticle. Those hash marks line up with yardage increments of your common straight-walled cartridges.
Yeah.
I think based on the yardages that they provide, I think they sort of focused on the 4570. So what was it? I forget now. It's the first, was it intended for the first hash mark to be 100 yards, like 100 yards zero? and then you've got 50 yard increments out to 300. Is that what I was saying?
I could be wrong, but I thought it was the first one was 50.
Okay.
But I could be wrong.
Well, either way, the hash marks line up with here, yeah, I pulled it up. So first hash or the center crosshair is 100 yards, first hash mark's 150, second is 200, third is 250, and then the top of you know, inset, if you look at, if you pull the reticle up, you'll know what I'm talking about. But like, you know, you have the thin line at the crosshair, and then they typically get wider at some port. So the top of that bottom post is 300 yards. They also provide tables for 350 Legend and 450 Bushmaster. So the yardages don't work out as perfectly. So for 350 Legend, again, center crosshair is 100 yards. First is 150. Second is 230. Third hash mark is 280. And top of the bottom post is 340. And for 450 Bushmaster, center is 100. First is 150. Second is 210, third is 260, top of the bottom post is 310. And they provide the, you know, the bullet weights and muzzle velocities that they base that off of. So, you know, for example, 350 Legend, that's based on a 150 grain bullet with a muzzle velocity of 2,325 feet per second. So, you know, obviously, with any of this optic stuff, if your ammo differs from that, those yardages are going to vary slightly. But, you know, you'll kind of be, I would imagine, you know, you're going to be minute of pie plate accurate with any, you know, any load, I guess, outside of like the subsonic stuff. You know, I know they sell some Sonic 350 Legend and probably 450 Bushmaster, like, you know, trajectory curves on that stuff are much different. But, you know, if you went with 180 grain 350 Legend, obviously your those ranges are going to be slightly different, but they're probably still a pretty close reference point. So I thought that was interesting to make people aware of, if you're, you know, if you need a new optic or you're getting a straight walled rifle for the upcoming deer season, it might be something to look at there.
Yeah, that's definitely cool. I mean, because that was a hard thing, you know, finding a scope for a 45-70, you know, that you're looking to deer hunt with can be hard, you know, because a 45-70 does apply a lot of shock, you know, so you need a shock proof scope. And then, right, you know, most of the scopes are not designed, you know, for that type of bullet drop compensation. So yeah, that's cool. And if I was in the market for a new scope, I'd definitely be getting one. But I like my scope. You know, I know where, you know, I can compensate out to, you know, 250 yards. I kind of can compensate for, so I'm set.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's in their, I guess I didn't mention, it's in their Crossfire 2 line. So it's a Crossfire 2 3-9 straight walled scope. Something to that effect is what they're calling it. I've got a Crossfire 2 on my shotgun and have had no issues with it. It, you know, it handles the recoil from a 12 gauge, no problem. So now my slug gun scope is just a standard crosshair. You know, it doesn't have, you know, yardage hash marks or whatever you want to call them. It's just a standard crosshair, but yeah. It's good to see, I guess, just to wrap it up, maybe it's good to see more support coming for the straight walled cartridges. You know, they continue to grow in popularity and you know, I know the ammo prices right now certainly have me considering one. Probably not this year, but I mean, for Sabo slugs, you know, you're looking at 18, 20 bucks a box of five, you know, so you're talking $4 a round right now. I mean, there for a while, I don't think you could find 350 Legend, but there for a while you couldn't find anything. I mean, you're seeing 350 Legend on the shelf now, and you know, I'm seeing it for $1.50 a round. So I don't know. Keep toying around with the idea of something straight walled. The other thing that I guess I wanted to chat with you guys briefly is, and maybe get some listener input on this. So I'm in the market for a 22 rifle. The problem is I don't know what I want. And so I've been doing a bunch of research here, and well, I know what I want, but they don't make it. I want a 10/22 with a threaded barrel. And now I know people who are 10/22 people will say, yeah, you can buy a 10/22 with a threaded barrel. And I know this, but I think right now you've got to buy like the takedown model, which, you know, the which is the one where it basically separates into two pieces. I don't know. I can't explain why I don't want a takedown model. I just don't. Or you've got to get into, I do think they sell some like Target models that have a threaded barrel, but you're getting far more expensive. So I guess I should add another stipulation. I want a 10/22 with a threaded barrel that's not a takedown in like standard base 10/22 price range. So it's led me down this path of, well, maybe I look at a bolt action 22. And you can buy the Savage Mark IIs for not a lot of money, but I've read a lot of, I don't know about a lot, but I've read some reviews, seen some reviews where right out of the gate, some of them are having extraction issues, or as you shoot them, they have extraction issues. Apparently I don't know if it's the spring force on the extractor, or I've seen some stuff where if you pull your extractor out and you sharpen it to where it bites onto the lip of the case better, it will fix the extraction issue. But then every so often you've got to redo that. And so you're talking about filing material off, replacing extractors once they've been filed too much. You know, I don't know if that's kind of a known issue on that rifle. I don't know that I want to get into a rifle that has a known issue like that. I kind of just want to buy a rifle that runs. So.
Right.
I mean, the price is really appealing on those. They now have, Savage now has the like their A22 and their B22s. The A22 is the semi-auto, basically 10/22 competitor. The B22 is a bolt action 22. I don't think they have, I don't know about the A22. I don't think the B22 has as much of an issue, but I have read some people still complain about extraction issues on the B22s. So then that led me to, well, Ruger sells a bolt action 22, the Ruger American Rimfire, and they offer it in 17, 22, and 22 mag. And I think that's where I'm leaning at the moment. What I originally wanted was a Thompson Center, I'm assuming after the 1022 patents expired, they made a 1022 clone, basically, except it comes with a threaded barrel on the standard model. The price is right. It's in that, you know, $300 to $400 price range. So it comes with a threaded barrel. It comes with a Magpul stock on it from the factory. And they've added a little tab on their magazines. It takes 1022 magazines. So it's a clone enough in that sense that it will use 1022 magazines. But if you use the Thompson magazines, they've added a little tab on there so you get last shot hold open on the bolt. 1022s the bolt doesn't lock back when on the last shot, which, you know, not a deal breaker, but it is kind of nice to, you know, have the action lock open when the gun's empty. I have a Mossberg 702 Plinkster that I think I paid $50 for from, I think it was a friend of our cousin or something like that. It locks open, same thing. It uses the magazine, like the follower in the magazine basically sticks up into the action and holds the action open once the last shell's gone. But I don't know. You guys have any thoughts on that? Which direction I should go?
Well, my question is, what are you looking to buy a 22 for? Like, what's the purpose of it?
So basically an upgrade from my Mossberg. That Mossberg has I don't know that I've ever had extraction issues. It has feeding issues to where, you know, it'll ram around up, you know, it just won't feed it in, right? It doesn't mm-hmm. go into the mm-hmm. into the chamber. So I sometimes have feeding issues. It sometimes has failure to fire issues, and that maybe that's an ammo thing, you know, where
right.
there's a dent on the case rim, but it didn't go off. Sometimes you can, you know, run those back through the gun and they'll go, you know, that's probably, you know, the Remington, whatever those, the green brick of Remington 22 yeah. stuff.
Yeah. I mean, rim fires are notorious for failure to fire, you know, issues.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it's just a cheap plastic gun. It mm-hmm. you know, the trigger's horrible, it's gritty, long, it's just, you know, it's mm-hmm. nothing special, right? It's a $50 gun. So just looking to get a real 22, hunt squirrels with, have Ella shoot it, you know, introduce her more to shooting. I mean, she shoots the Mossberg and, you know, loves shooting it, but, you know, we do have to deal with some of the feeding issues, and, you know, that's, while it's a good teaching moment, it is frustrating sometimes when, you know, gun goes click, doesn't go off, you know, rack a new shell in, gun goes click, you know, it's, so I guess that's what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Threaded, yeah. Because I ultimately someday, like not tomorrow, but someday I would like to put a suppressor on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because I guess the reason that I was asking is, while 1022s are fairly accurate, I mean, if you're looking to do real long range shooting with a 22, you know, a bolt action is where it's at. You know, bolt actions are typically much more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically all. You know, I have a Savage Mark II, I think, in, it's a 17 HMR. I think that's what it is, but it's a Savage bolt action.
Uh-huh.
And it's
is it a rotary magazine or a stacked magazine?
Stack. It's a stack.
Okay. Probably a Mark II then.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean that thing's impressive in how accurate it is. You know, because people complain about 17 HMRs, like, oh, you know, you can't hit anything because the wind, you know, throws that bullet everywhere. Well, I've shot it in pretty windy conditions at squirrels that are, I mean, to not overstate, I'll say at 75 yards.
Uh-huh.
And had no problem. You know, that squirrel's fallen out of the tree. You know,
yeah, so that takes me back to the Ruger American Rimfire. It takes 10/22 magazines. It's it's a Ruger. Ruger knows, right? They've been building the 10/22s for ever, and so they kind of know rimfires, and it takes so that that bolt action 22 that they make takes the 10/22 mags. So I guess that's why I'm kind of leaning that way at the moment. The CZs are nice, but they, you know, the price gets pretty high on those. So I guess listeners, if you have any of those rifles, the Savage, Jeff, you don't have any extraction issues with your Mark II?
Assuming no.
It's a Mark II?
Yeah, no, I don't have any issues.
Okay. I'll have to do some research on if people complain about extraction issues on all Mark IIs or just the 22 Mark IIs, or if this, you know, if the geometry of the 17s are different or what. So maybe it's a case of it's a somewhat entry level rifle, and if you get a good one, you get a good one. If you get a, you know, for whatever reason, you get one that has extraction issues, it has extraction issues. Although I did see some videos where, you know, it seems like Savage knows about it. Like the one guy said, you know, he bought this rifle, he called Savage, and basically all he had to say was, you know, Mark II extraction, and they're like, yep, say no more, we'll send you some new extractors. And so they just sent him a couple new extractors, and he said the new extractor seemed to have, I don't know if it totally eliminated the issue, but certainly reduced the frequency. So I don't know. Maybe I'm not ruling out the Mark IIs. The price is really good on the Mark IIs. Like, I think you can buy Mark IIs sub $300, which is quite appealing. But like I said, listeners, if you have any experience with any of those, the Savage A22s, B22s, the Mark II, Savage Mark II, the Ruger American Rimfire, or something else that I am not aware of. I never mentioned the reason, I was ready to buy one of these Thompson Center R22s, TCR 22s. But I started calling around to the local gun shops and nobody can get them. And I don't know if that's I've got two theories. That's just a function of the current state of the gun industry, labor shortage, whatever. But the one guy made some kind of comment. I think the Thompson brand is maybe owned by Smith & Wesson. And he made just sort of offhandedly said something about, I don't know if I can get those. I think Smith & Wesson is going to discontinue the Thompson Center line, but let me check. And he, you know, put me on hold and come back and said, yeah, I can't get any, and they don't show up on any of my, you know, through any of my wholesalers. So then it was like, well, I don't know that I want to get into, you know, if they're going to discontinue them, even though it is a 10/22 clone. And I think a lot of the 1022 parts can be used in the TCR-22. So just another element, I guess, on my my shopping saga. So if anybody has any experience with any of those rifles, or, you know, pros or cons, either way, I'd love to hear them. So with that, I think we've been talking long enough. Probably ought to switch this one off. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think that's good.
That's it for this week. So hopefully this was something interesting. Maybe you were aware of this, maybe you weren't, but I think to Jeff's point, it's important for us to all stay up to date on these kind of things and make sure that we as hunters are aware of them, and try to make the non-hunting public aware of the good that we do for conservation as hunters. To the non-hunting public, it can seem quite counterintuitive, but, you know, the vast majority of those conservation dollars come from us hunters. So we need to paint ourselves in a good light and let people know about that. So with that, that's going to be it for this week. As always, follow us on social, Ohio Huntsman on Facebook, Ohio Huntsman _podcast on Instagram. And with that, I think we'll shut it off and talk to everybody next week. Thanks for listening.